Hello and welcome to Behind the News. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. And I hope I managed to compose myself after that attack by an environmental toxin. I think I've got everything under control, but you never know. I got three interviews up tonight. First, in a little while, we'll speak with Greg Smith of the Pew Center about their new report on religion in the United States. Very interesting portrait of far more diversity, far more fluidity, fewer and fewer Protestants, it seems. So we'll talk to Greg Smith of the Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life in a couple of minutes about that. And then we'll speak in about 15 minutes or so with Gary Gates, who is a fellow at the Williams Center, a law school based at the law school at UCLA, which is a think tank devoted to gay and lesbian issues. Now, this nod to Pride Week is to take a look at the economic impact and the social impact of same-sex marriage, now, of course, legal in California, a spreading national trend, probably inevitable over time. We will look at some of the economic and fiscal impact of that. And then at the bottom of the hour, an interview recorded a little while ago with David Kirsch, who is an economist and market analyst at PFC Energy. We'll talk to him about a pretty detailed discussion of why oil is $140 a barrel, and why it's having the effects it does, what's going on with supply, are we at the peak in production or near the peak in production, what is responsible for these enormously high oil prices, and why haven't they had more of an economic effect than they actually have? They've certainly caused people a lot of financial distress, no doubt about that, but it hasn't created the kind of deep recession that one might would have expected, and certainly it seemed to do back in the 1970s, but not this time around, having more of an inflationary effect than a recessionary effect. Kind of interesting story there. But anyway, we'll get the whole picture from David Kirsch in a little while. I'm going to keep these opening economic comments short because we are bursting at the seams with guests today. Earlier this week, the Federal Reserve met and did nothing. That is, its policy-setting group, the Federal Open Market Committee, had one of its regular meetings, which happened about once every 6 weeks, and they left interest rates unchanged. This was really no surprise. Neither was the statement that they issued right after the meeting. The time was many years ago when the Federal Reserve didn't reveal what it had thought or done. And you really couldn't even tell if they changed policy unless you were one of these very highly paid Fed watchers who could discern it from the tea leaves. But now they actually tell what they've been doing and to some degree what they've been thinking. Well, they're sometimes a little coy about that. But anyway, the statement they issued after the meeting upped the rhetorical volume about inflation. It's something they're concerned about and watching very, very closely, and turned down the volume on financial crisis and economic weakness. The reason all this was no surprise is that the Fed can't really do much of anything else. They know the economy and financial system are still too fragile to handle the first of a round of interest rate hikes, and that's the way they usually move, not just with one little move, but a string of them. Yet the Fed knows that inflation, particularly in energy and food, is a persistent and serious problem. So they're hoping that professions of concern will preserve that thing they value so highly, credibility, without actually risking a deep recession to prove it. Maybe they're right, and the passage of time will do the trick and heal these inflationary and stagnationary problems. Financial problems could work themselves out, although the housing market is still weak and the financial markets are hardly in the pink of health. And the economy could recover spontaneously in 6 or 12 months, though there's no sign of this yet. Keep your fingers crossed. Okay, now we're joined on the line by Greg Smith, who is a fellow at the Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life, and was involved in producing a very large and interesting report they just came out with on religion in America today. And welcome to Behind the News, Greg Smith.
Thank you for having me.
So we've only got a few minutes, so let's race through the headlines here. First of all, it's no no news that the religious landscape in America is quite diverse, but it's much more volatile and fluid than I guessed before reading your report. Give us the rundown on that.
Well, I think you're right to point out that there's a very high degree of fluidity that characterizes religion in the United States, and I think probably the number one place you see that is the large number of people who report switching religions. One of the key findings from our first report that we released a couple of months ago is that if you include movement within Protestantism, then upwards of 4 in 10 Americans have a religious affiliation today that's different than the faith in which they were raised.
But they're also not as rigid as one would have guessed. You know, sometimes you think that this is a country full of Bible-thumping, snake-handling, tongue-speaking fundamentalist Protestants, but it's really not quite like that, is it?
Well, there's a couple things I'd say. First of all, the survey confirms, as does so much other research, that the United States really is a religious nation. Most people say that religion is very important in their lives. Most people attend religious services on at least an occasional basis. Most people pray every day. So the United States really is a nation of believers. It's a nation of people for whom religion is important.
And we're outliers among the rich countries of the world.
Absolutely. The United States is quite unique compared to other industrialized nations in that respect. However, one of the striking findings of the survey is that despite that high level of relatively high level of religious commitment, it's also true that most Americans take a non-dogmatic, flexible approach, if you will, when it comes to matters of faith. And by that, what I mean is that among religiously affiliated people, 7 in 10 say that many religions can lead to eternal life, not just their own. And a similar number says that there's more than one true way to interpret the teachings of their own faith. And we were struck by that.
Yeah, the time was when, you know, the days of Jonathan Edwards, there was only one way, and things have eased up considerably. What do you think is responsible for this?
It's hard to know exactly what's responsible for this. One of the things we're going to be doing later this year is a recontact survey of many of the people that we already interviewed and exploring this in a little bit more detail. But I can say that, you know, one of the things that's striking and that you already mentioned is the great diversity of religion in the United States. People frequently, in many different aspects of their lives, come into contact with people from a variety of religious backgrounds. I should point out that this holds true even in people's own families. We find that nearly 4 in 10 married people are married to someone of a religious background different than their own. And so it's the openness or the flexibility that people express about matters of faith is consistent with the great diversity that exists within the United States and even within many American families.
But still running down this table here on the first page of the report, of those who are religious in this country, the overwhelming majority, but more than three quarters, are Christian, right?
And yes, almost 8 in 10 Americans are Christian.
Of some sort, and about half of them are Protestants, although you point out we're on the verge of becoming a minority Protestant nation for the first time in our history.
Yes, if you look back at other surveys that have been done over the last several decades, and in this report we look at the General Social Survey conducted out of the University of Chicago, the number of Protestants has been steadily declining over the last, let's say, 40 to 50 years. And at the same time, the number of people who are unaffiliated with any religion has been growing.
And what about age cohorts? Is there any pattern among those?
Well, if you look at young people overall, people under the age of 30, say, they are more likely than any other age group to say that they are unaffiliated with any particular religion. And by several measures of religious commitment, like frequency of church attendance and the number who say that they believe in God with absolute certainty, frequency of prayer, these kinds of things, young people tend to be less religious than their older counterparts.
At the same time, we also are seeing a growth in the number of what you call unaffiliated people who are neither not religious at all or religious in some vague but uninstitutionalized way, right?
That's right. The key thing to remember there is that, and as you touched on, is that the group of people who is unaffiliated with any particular religion is really, like all the religious groups in the United States, quite diverse. You've got that group at about 16% of the public. It includes some people who really are quite secular in their outlook. It includes atheists and agnostics and other people who say they're not affiliated with any group and religion really isn't important to them at all. But it also includes a fair number of people who aren't affiliated with any particular religion, but who nevertheless say that religion is at least somewhat important in their lives. We call them the religious unaffiliated.
And then also, even despite the extensive amount of immigration from Asia, Middle East to the country, the number of Buddhists and Muslims and Hindus, well, not zero, is actually kind of small, isn't it?
It is quite small. We estimate the number of Muslims, Hindus, and Buddhists all at less than 1% of the population each. So they are still a small part of the U.S. population. You know, and you mentioned immigration. The important thing to remember about immigration, or the important thing to point out about immigrants to the United States, is that they really are reinforcing the Christian character of the United States. Most immigrants to the U.S. are Christians, and in particular, they are partly responsible for maintaining the proportion of Americans who are Catholic. Immigrants are disproportionately Catholic.
Yeah, this country is full of ex-Catholics like me, isn't it?
It certainly is. We estimate that roughly 1 in 10 adults in the United States were raised Catholic and are no longer Catholic. In fact, the Catholic Church has, if you look at the number of people who have left each religion and the number of people who have entered each religion, the Catholic Church net has lost more members than has really any other religious group.
But there's also been a lot of shuffling around within the Protestant category, hasn't there?
Absolutely. If you look at, we talked a moment ago about how overall the number of Protestants has been on the decline. The best evidence suggests that most of that decline has been concentrated within the Protestant mainline denominations like the Episcopal Church in the USA, the United Methodist Church, the United Church of Christ, and so on, whereas the Protestant evangelical tradition has held steady or even may perhaps grown a little bit over the same period of time.
And what about the relative socioeconomic status of the religions? Who's, you know, high income, high status? Who's low income, lower status?
Well, what's interesting is that Jews, and perhaps somewhat surprisingly, just in the sense that there hasn't been much research done on this beforehand, Hindus are among the most well-educated and the groups that earn the highest household incomes. At the other end of the spectrum, you have evangelical Protestants as well as Jehovah's Witnesses who tend to be lower on the socioeconomic spectrum.
Evangelical Protestants, that mixes white and black varieties?
It certainly does. We define religion here in this report based on people's specific denominational affiliation. So, for instance, if you told us you're a member of the Southern Baptist Convention, then we placed you in the evangelical tradition regardless of your race. Interestingly, too, I should also point out that if you told us you're a member of the National Baptist Convention or the American Methodist Episcopal denomination, you are in this survey in the historically black tradition, whether or not you're black. We really tried as much as we could to sort people out based on their specific religious denominational affiliation rather than on the basis of their religious beliefs or their racial and ethnic characteristics.
And finally, what can we extrapolate something for the future out of this? Does it look like the unaffiliated category is going to continue to gain, I mean, given its prevalence among younger people?
Well, you know, that's really the key, is what happens with the younger people. If it turns out that the younger people, as they age, become more religious, then I don't know how much more growth we can expect to see in the unaffiliated population. If, however, they maintain their current levels of religion or current levels of having disassociated themselves from religious groups, then yes, it's likely that that group is likely to continue to grow.
And do we have a hint of how that might turn out? Do people get more religious as they get older?
I think some of them do, but there's also a lot of evidence to suggest that there's also real generational components to this as well, that young people, the people who were not particularly religious a generation ago still tend not to be particularly religious today.
All right. Well, thank you for joining us.
Been speaking
with
Greg
Smith, who is with the Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life. And you can get this report on the web at pewforum.org, pewforum.org. Okay, let's take a musical break, and we'll be back to talk about same-sex marriage and such topics. And that's some of the Mekons doing the old Graham Parsons song, $1,000 Wedding. And we're now joined on the line by Gary Gates, who is with the Williams Institute, which is a think tank on gay and lesbian issues based at the UCLA Law School. Welcome to Behind the News, Gary.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
So let's start by talking about just the general picture of same-sex couples in the United States. And you tell us, first of all, where you get this information from.
Well, most of our information on same-sex couples comes from the U.S. Census Bureau, either through the 2000 census or more recently from another survey that they do called the American Community Survey.
Do we have any idea how accurate these numbers are? I mean, people might lie to census takers, might they?
They might. I mean, we suspect that there's an undercount involved, although I think that undercount has been improving over time. For example, in the 2000 census, there were less than 600,000 same-sex couples reported in the U.S., and the current figure stands, this is as of 2006, at 780,000. So there's a fair bit of evidence that folks are becoming more willing to identify on these forms.
And what can we say about these same-sex couples? How do they compare with the non-same-sex population?
Well, a fair few of them have children. Around a quarter of them are raising children. In different-sex couples, that would be about half of them. So they are less likely to be raising children. But, you know, I think one of the important things is, one, that they're present in virtually, you know, every community in the United States. And curiously, they're becoming more visible in some of the most conservative parts of the country. If you look at the increases that I talked about, those increases have been much larger in the Midwest and the Upper South, some of the more conservative parts of the country.
And as you were saying, that the TV in the studio was just flashing images from the Staten Island Pride Parade earlier today, which is not a kind of a locale you associate with rainbow flags.
The other curious thing, and this isn't based so much on my data, but anecdotally I find it fascinating that most gay pride, or a lot of gay pride festivals now, have to have bouncy castles and swing sets and things for kids. And I dare say that 10, 15 years ago, that wasn't a big consideration.
What about the income levels of same-sex households? Any different from the broader population?
In general, they're actually not hugely different. I mean, when you look at individual incomes, men in same-sex couples actually earn less than their married counterparts. Women in same-sex couples earn a bit more than women who are married to men. But as household incomes, obviously, when you have two male incomes and compare it to households where you might have a male and female income, male couples tend to do a bit better. I think one of the most interesting findings around household income is that same-sex couples with children, both male and female, tend to be quite substantially disadvantaged economically relative to married couples.
Why
they generally have incomes quite a bit lower.
Oh, just
Why is that? One is that they're a little more likely to be female couples, but like I said, even in male couples, it's lower. I think one of the other things that many people don't realize is that child-rearing among same-sex couples, it's much more prevalent among non-white couples.
Yeah.
And the rates of child-rearing among African-American and Latinos and Latinas in same-sex couples are 2 to 3 times that of their white counterparts.
Now, of course, this is at odds with the conventional image of
right.
gay men in particular as carefree and full of disposable income.
Yes.
That's really not a fair picture at all, is it?
Not really. I mean, I think, you know, I think there is something to be said that yes, gay men are less likely to have children, and so certainly they can spend their money, you know, differently than their heterosexual counterparts who have kids, perhaps. But, you know, I think that's just such a small portion of the gay pie that has been focused on in the media, and I think it's a pretty unfair portrayal.
So when you put all these numbers together and what you've been saying and what's in this this profile at the Williams Institute published, it looks like same-sex couples are pretty much like everyone else. They work. they're very highly likely to have kids.
Exactly.
They face the same the pleasures and pains as everyone else.
Right. And I think the story is, you know, it's not quite that you know, gay and lesbian people or same-sex couples are, you know, exactly like their heterosexual counterparts. But I think it's important to suggest that in a lot of key areas, particularly many of the areas that we associate with things like marriage, there's a fairly large proportion who look quite similar. And it becomes increasingly difficult to say that somehow they're different, and so, you know, they're kind of not eligible for marriage when you compare them to their already married counterparts.
So thank you. You've done my segue for me. Now that you're in California, right?
Right.
Speaking of a state that has just seen the first wave of same-sex marriage, how's that going?
I mean, it appears to be happening at a fairly brisk pace. Curiously, one of the results of the ruling here is that they don't ask your sex on the marriage license anymore, the idea being it's marriage. You know, it doesn't matter whether it's a same-sex couple or different-sex couple. So it's been a little bit difficult to get, you know, terribly precise counts. But we do know that in most of the, certainly in the large counties, applications for marriage licenses have been running 2 to 3 times the average. So, you know, it seems to be happening at a fairly brisk pace.
Yeah, now that's, of course, nice from a human rights point of view, but frustrating for demography.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, as I recall, the experience in other states that have legalized both civil unions or, in Massachusetts' case, marriage,
right.
That there's an initial burst and then it sort of peters down.
Yeah, I mean, clearly, you know, there's a pent-up demand for marriage in particular or for legal recognition. I mean, I think what's interesting is that initial burst is dramatically higher was dramatically higher in Massachusetts than any other jurisdiction. So when it was marriage, the burst, almost a third of same-sex couples in Massachusetts got married in that first year. And in other states where there were civil unions or domestic partnerships, it was, you know, closer to 10% in the first year. So there's clearly a kind of bigger initial demand for marriage. But yeah, and then it does kind of level off, which you would expect to happen over time. If you look at from where the couples sort of started at the beginning in Massachusetts, about a half of them were married after about 3 years.
Now, as I recall, in Massachusetts, marriage is only available to residents, but in California, it can be out-of-staters.
That's right. That's,
yes.
That's one of the big differences with the California ruling, in that California opens, you know, there isn't a residency requirement, so anyone from around the country or around the world could come and get married in California.
And you and your colleagues at the Williams Institute have done some work showing that this could be a economic stimulus to California.
We did. We made some projections as to both how many in-state couples might get married and how many couples from out of the country, and try to look at whatever data we could to make those estimates hopefully, you know, reasonably accurate, and come to the conclusion that it's will probably be in 3 years about $700 million of additional spending on weddings here in the state, and that could increase state tax coffers by somewhere around $50 or $60 million.
And what about the fiscal impact? You also saw a positive fiscal impact from that.
Yeah, so that's, I mean, in terms of the impact to the state tax rolls, you know, we estimate that the state would add an additional $50 or $60 million to the budget, to the state budget.
And where would this this flow of dollars come from?
A lot of it is just sales tax revenue and various kind of taxes on hotels and tourism, as well as just additional marriages. And, you know, there's a license fee associated with getting married, so there would be literally an additional amount of marriages happening.
So is that winning any friends in among the skeptics in California?
Well, I mean, I don't know that that's going to make a, you know, be a key argument in people's decisions. But, you know, the truth is California is facing a fairly dire budget situation in the next few years. And, you know, you haven't mentioned it, but in California, it's likely that there's going to be a referendum on the ballot in November that would potentially add a constitutional amendment that would ultimately ban marriage for same-sex couples. And if that were to happen, one, these funds, you know, would go away. And, you know, it's not clear that people wouldn't sort of consider that in that decision.
What now we have two states now that recognize same-sex marriage.
Right.
What is this going to do nationally? I mean, this gets to be a significant. These are not small states, especially California.
No, I mean California. Again, if this, you know, if this remains, you know, a permanent situation in California, obviously it changes the playing field in the U.S. in terms of marriage rights for same-sex couples. I mean, already, not just is it true that you can get married in California and Massachusetts, but New York has now, the governor has announced that the state will recognize those marriages. So when you throw New York into the pot, you know, it's now more than a quarter of U.S. residents live in a place where same-sex couples, their marriages can be recognized. So, you know, I think that does put some pressure, at the very least, on the federal government to say how are we going to treat these couples. Right now, the Defense of Marriage Act says they're not married by, you know, under federal law, and it creates a variety of tax and a whole host of other problems for these couples. And I think, given the size of the issue now, that I think the federal government might sort of reconsider that position.
You know, especially if there's a change of administration.
Well, I would think that would probably hasten it a little more than at the current pace.
But now we have, what is it, 1,183 rights and responsibilities, somebody counted, associated with
right.
marriage. Other states, are they obligated to recognize, say, visitation rights in hospitals?
No. Where it gets, in general, most of the rights, a state isn't obligated, unless you have a, you know, a power of attorney or some kind of actual legal document apart from your marriage certificate. In general, states don't have to recognize the marriage performed in another state, particularly. I mean, that was one of the elements of the Defense of Marriage Act, was that the federal government said no state is required to recognize. There are ways, though, like I said, with some of those things, with durable powers of attorney and health, you know, that you can set those up contractually, and the states should recognize those contracts. Now, obviously, for a heterosexual married couple, you don't have to do that because the marriage is recognized. But, you know, I think that how these states deal with this recognition, again, is something that I think will begin to evolve over time, particularly because I think it will become a more and more pressing issue if marriage remains available here in California.
Well, it does seem like the tide of history, at least we hope.
It does.
All right, well, thank you for joining us. I've been speaking with Gary Gates, who is with the Williams Institute, a think tank on gay and lesbian issues based at the UCLA Law School. Well, let's take a break, and we'll be back to talk about oil.
Yo, this is G-Love on WBAI, New York, New York.
And this is WBAI, not only in New York at 99.5 on your FM dial, but also on the web at WBAI.org. My name is Doug Henwin. The program is Behind the News. And let's take a musical break.
I need a cheeseburger to go.
And that's some of the Gang of Four's anthem to classic American loves, cheap gas and plentiful cheeseburgers, and both more than a little bit under siege lately, especially the cheap gas part of it. That leads us to the next interview I recorded earlier in the week with David Kirsch, who is a market analyst at PFC Energy. He is orthodox, I have to concede, but sophisticated and enlightening analyst of what's going on in the oil market. So let's listen to David Kirsch. Thanks for joining us, David Kirsch. The standard story of why oil prices are kissing $140 a barrel is that we've had strong demand coming from rapid growth in China, India, elsewhere in Asia, flat supply, supply not growing in the face of this rising demand. How accurate is that standard story?
Yeah, that's actually fairly accurate. From about 2000 till now, 80% of the growth has actually come from areas outside the OECD. It has been China. It has been India and Southeast Asia, but it has also been from the Middle East itself. You know, it's a region we think of for the supply of crude oil, but not so much for the demand. But that's a region that's fast growing and is rivaling China as the fastest growing energy market globally. I think for the U.S. And especially for American consumers, it's somewhat unsettling in that traditionally it's been the U.S., which remains the world's largest oil market, that sets the tone for global oil prices and also helps dictate what the prices at the pump is going to be. And this year, despite having very low demand, actually negative demand growth year on year in the U.S. and particularly for gasoline, we're looking at $4 a barrel because of growth in places like China, Saudi Arabia, and Iran.
And the Middle East now is consuming more and exporting less?
To a certain extent. I mean, it remains a very large exporter, and countries like Saudi Arabia have actually seen their exports of crude oil surpass their incremental demand, so they're actually extending their role as a net exporter. A country like Iran has really been in the headlines for its difficulties, one, in maintaining crude oil production at about 4 million barrels per day, and also how it's had runaway gasoline demand, forcing it to actually import the product. And there, it's now the second largest importer of gasoline worldwide, behind only the United States.
Now, how reliable are the numbers, especially on the supply side and the reserve side? Do we really know, or is this just the various sources come up with different numbers? Are these just educated guesses, or what?
Yeah, it's actually very difficult to say with any reliability how much reserves we actually have, particularly when we look at the major resource holders in the Middle East that have nationalized their oil sectors and allow only limited or no participation from international oil companies, or at least those that are publicly traded, and would have to provide an audit of any type of reserve data. We can go back and we can kind of make some educated guesses, especially based on data that was available before the nationalizations. We can look at announcements that have been made. And in the case of Saudi Arabia, we can also look at some of the behavior that we've seen, the production levels and the changes in production levels, and tells us a little bit about its capacity and its capability. But ultimately, at the end of the day, you have to take those numbers at face value, and you know, either discount it based on what you think may be behind it or not. We don't know the full truth, but some countries, as opposed to others, we're more inclined to believe what the governments are telling us.
Obviously, oil price is not just a function of regular supply and demand, but there's political issues involved, and of course, the controversial matter of speculation. I want to take these each in turn. First of all, how much of the oil price, obviously it's very difficult to quantify, but give us some idea of the magnitude. How much of it is the result of political anxieties, like the situation in Iraq, fear about war in Iran, political troubles coming out of Chavez in Venezuela, the repeated attacks and installations in Nigeria? What's the contribution of that to $140 oil?
Well, I think if we look at the invasion of Iraq and the continuing turbulence there, if we look at the problems that we've had in Venezuela as well as Nigeria, there's a very definite contribution to the prices of oil, because all of these incidents have actually taken real volumes of oil off the market. You know, for example, we estimate that Venezuela is now producing somewhere around 2.5 million barrels per day. Caracas itself claims that its actual production is around 3.3 million barrels per day, a figure that it was close to before the strike by the National Oil Company in 2003. Now, just in that one swoop, we think we've lost about 800,000 barrels per day over the last 5 years because of how the strike was handled and how the fields were shut in. Similarly, in Nigeria, there's roughly 800,000 barrels per day shut in because of militant violence. And also, too, in Iraq, we're still not yet up to pre-invasion output levels, despite the positive increases over the last several months. So that has definitely kept markets tighter, taken off significant volumes of oil overall. I think adding to that is this anxiety that there could be additional attacks, you know, perhaps in Nigeria. There could be additional aggression that could lead to attacks between the U.S. And Iran, for example. And this is adding to some of the anxieties in the market, given the fact that we only have about 2 to 2.5 million barrels per day of spare capacity left. That represents somewhere around 3 to 3.5% of total world demand. So we're at 97% utilization. Of course, you're going to have high prices in that environment, and a lot of anxiety over any potential disruptions to that supply.
What about the issue of peak oil? There are a lot of people who think that we're close to or have already passed the peak in production. Is that a real thing that is affecting market prices today?
I think that's very definitely factoring into prices. And I think there's a lot of fear that we have gone into the peak. You know, peak oil is a very real thing. When you see oil reservoirs produce about between 50 and 60% of their reserves, they go into irreversible decline. You can slow the rate of decline somewhat, but it is going to go into decline. And in many of the non-OPEC countries, we know that these countries are already going into decline, and any new discoveries in those countries are only going to likely offset or slow that decline. It cannot reverse it. The big question marks come in on whether or not OPEC has gone into decline or not. Some countries clearly have, Indonesia being the notable one. And for that reason, they'll be leaving OPEC at the end of the year. But there are significant question marks specifically about Saudi Arabia and whether it can go to its potential that it stated of 15 million barrels per day, or some believing that it's actually having a hard time maintaining even current production levels of about 9.5 million barrels per day. And I think that's one of the main anxieties for the long term that's playing into current oil prices.
The Saudis have a couple of projects under construction now, and they're talking they could bring some more on stream. How realistic is that, and would it make a major difference in the coming years?
Yeah, I think it actually should. The major project for this year is Khursaniya, which will add about 600,000 barrels per day, or about half of world growth accounted for in just a single project. Next year, they'll bring on the Khurais project, which is one of the largest oil projects
you've ever seen, larger than many countries own oil output at about 1.2 million barrels per day. That should also be more than meeting the incremental demand growth that we're expecting next year. In these projects, there have been some delays, notably in Karais, some problems with a contractor on some gas treatment facilities that have delayed commissioning of the plant until August. But you know, we're looking at delays in Saudi Arabia of a few months, whereas when we look at the offshore deep water, particularly off the coast of Africa, even Brazil, and this, to a large extent even in our own backyard in the Gulf of Mexico, there we're looking at delays that we measure in terms of years. So the problems with Saudi Arabia are relatively minor in the grand scheme of problems afflicting the global oil and gas industry so far.
The structure of the oil ownership these days is certainly different from what it was 40 years ago. Much of the oil in the world is now owned by national oil companies. How much does that matter for supply? Would that picture change if the majors were allowed in a major way?
Yeah, I don't think it changes dramatically just because the national oil companies own that. Now, certainly there's going to be some countries, if we take a look, for example, at Iran. Iran's having real difficulty maintaining current production levels, and certainly we're not going to see it achieving stated goals of 4.5 million barrels per day or higher production. Now, this isn't necessarily, however, because the National Iranian Oil Company lacks any technical capacity. Rather, for political reasons, it's starved of capital.
That means you're talking about sanctions.
No, not necessarily. This is Tehran is actually looking at NIOC to fund first and foremost populist spending measures, rather than taking retained earnings and reinvesting that in the oil sector. This is actually a trend that we see in several different countries, Mexico and Venezuela being two other key countries where this phenomenon is occurring. Now, even though in the case of Iran, if sanctions were to be lifted tomorrow and there was no penalty for any international oil company going into the oil sector, that's also not dramatically going to change matters, even with the technology or the capital they bring to the table, quite simply because the contract terms on offer from Tehran are not particularly attractive to the international majors.
They are getting what apparently look like some favorable terms in Iraq. What do you make of this report of no-bid deals to bring back some of the old players in the Iraqi oil industry?
Yeah, exactly. Well, the no-bid is actually a misnomer. These are extensions of the MOUs that have been worked out over the past several months. And Iraq is looking at these as a technical service agreement as a measure to bridge over to what they hope will be the new hydrocarbon law in a full-on bid round, optimistically at the end of this year. I think the contract that they're looking at, too, it's also not a huge gift to the oil companies. The terms have been very tough. The expectations for production are actually quite high, and some of the companies are expressing some concern about whether or not they'll be able to meet their obligations under these contracts. But should everything go forward, we're looking at actually a further increment of potentially 500,000 barrels per day. Again, something along the lines of about what half of world oil demand will be next year. So this should go a long way towards meeting new crude oil demand and helping to ease high crude prices.
I was speaking with David Kirsch of PFC Energy, and I neglected to ask you the speculation question. This is, of course, a great political controversy. What are the contributions of hedge funds and other professional speculators in pushing up oil prices?
Well, I think it goes well beyond the actual professional speculators. I think they're actually playing a very small role, quite frankly. But if we look at the larger role of financial players, people just looking for a healthy return, and compared with debt or equities, commodities is the place to be, and oil is a very healthy commodity. They're clearly playing a role, I think, in extending the peaks and the valleys of bullish and bearish runs that we've had and the speed with which we hit those numbers. But I think the underlying fundamentals give them the basis for these current prices. And even if we look at $140 a barrel oil, despite the pain Americans are feeling and despite some demand destruction that we're seeing overall, the global economy, or I should say the global oil economy, is still functioning.
Yeah, that's interesting because, you know, you would have thought that $140 oil would have driven us into a recession, possibly a deep one, but although it does seem to be slowing down economic growth, it doesn't seem to be fatal to it. Is this just a temporary thing? Are we going to feel this pain over the longer term, or is the world that much less oil dependent than it was 30 years ago?
I think the world is a lot less oil dependent, and I think, you know, much more oil efficient has been a key element. But I think part of it as well, too, is there needs to be even greater efficiencies to be gained, particularly if you're going to have this problem with peak oil in non-OPEC production, and you're going to continue to have strong demand growth. You cannot continue to have strong demand growth and expect to have reasonably cheap oil prices. I think this is one of the reasons that you're seeing a bit up of oil prices too, is understanding that we need to squeeze some more demand out of the market, or at least some of these financial players are understanding that. And where you're seeing is the squeeze in the refining margins. And it is ultimately squeezing, say, you know, now maybe a couple hundred thousand barrels per day of demand out of the market.
Who exactly does set oil prices? I think a lot of people think that OPEC is still in the driver's seat, but we are a long way from the days when OPEC, or even before that, the Texas Railroad Commission set oil prices. Is it the traders in the on the futures exchanges? What are the forces responsible for setting oil prices?
Yeah, ultimately, I think the forces that set the day-to-day oil prices, or, you know, actually we can talk about the minute-by-minute oil prices, that is going to be your Wall Street traders who on the NYMEX exchange are essentially giving you the price for the West Texas Intermediate crude, or in London for Brent, off of which most physical crude oil trades are priced. I think at the end of the day, obviously, OPEC has a very heavy influence in setting the basis for the long-term trends in prices, but not in setting the day-to-day prices. And, you know, ultimately, too, even if Wall Street gets carried away with itself, at the end of the day, you have to sell your oil to a refinery. And if they're not making money processing crude at those prices, then they refuse to buy. So you do see some physical market convergence. You see some limits on where Wall Street can go, both from the refiners and from OPEC itself. But ultimately, at the end of the day, it's the participants in those commodity exchanges that are giving us our prices.
You do hear complaints from refiners that their margins are squeezed, and with oil prices as high as they are, you'd think that they'd be doing a lot better. What's up with the refiners?
Well, with the refineries, particularly in the United States, these guys are configured to maximize as much gasoline production as they possibly can. However, what the world is really demanding right now is diesel and a little bit some jet fuel. Remember, most of the demand that we're seeing is coming from the Middle East and Asia, or in emerging markets, where diesel is a much more prevalent fuel than gasoline is. So that's really hurting the U.S. refiners. But what's hurting refiners more generally is that the price of crude has been rising much more rapidly than the price of refined products has, so squeezing the refiners' margins down significantly. They're still making money, however, and obviously no one's going to be crying a long trail of tears for the poor refiners, but their margins, their profitability is being squeezed, which does point to some weakness in this current bull run, and suggest that, you know, the claims that we're going to get to $150 or $200 a barrel by the end of the year might be a little optimistic.
To what extent do you think this price is a bubble that you know, George Soros says it's going to pop someday? Is that a reasonable projection?
Yeah, I think there's some bubbly aspects to it, especially the sentiment that we can only go up from here, or that this run still has plenty of room to grow. Given the effect that we've had on demand, it is only a quarter of the world market, but it's the U.S. market is the one where we had the best data. Given the absolutely atrocious figures we're seeing for gasoline and even diesel demand in this market, it suggests to us that you don't have a lot of room to go up further. I think if there is a push by the financial community to try and take oil prices higher, I think that is going to have a very bad effect on refining margins and demand more generally, and that demand response will lead to a quick correction, probably down to, I think, probably $120 by the end of the year. Seems more realistic than $150 or even $200.
And what about the immediate political question on the offshore drilling? How much would that help? Is it worth it, or is it just political posturing?
Well, I think it's a separate issue from current high prices. Now, obviously, our view would be you've got tight supplies. You would want to open up whatever areas are possible to meet those supplies. Now, obviously, you're running into some environmental concerns, and we think that's probably where you should be framing the debate, is on the trade-off between long-term energy supplies and environmental. In particular, can you do this in an environmental way? Because of the time scales involved here, you're not really going to be able to address current gasoline prices at all, even if areas in the Gulf of Mexico off of California or Alaska were open tomorrow. You're not going to see first oil for 5 to 7 years.
And finally, a practical question. Out of that $4 or $4.20 that people pay for a gallon of gas, where does that money go? How much goes to the likes of ExxonMobil? How much to Saudi Arabia? How much to taxes? How much to the guy who runs the filling station? How's that pie split up?
Yeah, the guy who's getting really the short end of the stick is the guy running the filling station, most likely. Those are the margins that are getting squeezed the most, and we're actually seeing some of the major companies that have the branded stations actually getting out of ownership for some of those reasons. I mean, where you make your money at a gas station is by selling the Cokes and the candy bars. It's roughly in the United States, a rough rule of thumb is about one-third is the cost of oil, one-third goes to taxes of various kinds or another, and one-third goes to the refiner. Given the current high prices of crude oil, you know, those breakdowns are shifting somewhat, and crude is probably up to about 40-45% of the cost of a price of a gallon of gas.
And how is the amount that goes to crude split between the oil majors and countries like Saudi Arabia?
Well, in Saudi Arabia, if it's Saudi crude, it's all Saudi Aramco, so of course they're getting 100% of that. But even if we're looking at states, at countries where, for example, Nigeria, where oil companies are the operators, and sometimes the 100% equity owners of the oil fields, the government take at current oil prices can be anywhere between 50% all the way up to 90% of the price of oil. It depends on how the contract has been structured, but there's normally a sliding scale so that the government takes an ever-increasing stake of oil prices, of the share of revenues as prices go up.
And last word, are we ever likely to see $2 gas again?
$2 gas, not sure about that one. Probably not. I think you've got too many incentives out there from among the producers to try to keep $100 a barrel of oil as a floor. So maybe we'll see $3 a gallon gas again, but probably get used to $4 or even higher.
Well, that should make you a popular guy. All right, thanks for joining us, David Kirsch.
And that was David Kirsch, who is a market analyst at PFC Energy, a consultancy, a global energy consultancy based in Washington, D.C. And, of course, not much in that interview about the urgency of getting beyond oil, which I think is perhaps the most profound question facing the world today, or very close to the top. And I'm not quite sure I accept that view of what's going on with the oil majors getting back into Iraq. But in any case, we'll look at both those issues in the coming weeks and months. All right, that's it for me, Doug Henwood. Stay tuned for the news and on into the evening. I will be back next week, and let's go out with this from Beethoven's Waldstein Sonata performed by Alfred Brendel. Till next week, bye.